Beverly Wright, director of the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice at Dillard University, and Walter Strong, the executive vice president of Dillard University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Wright, you organized a conference last weekend on race and the environment at Dillard. Why did you schedule this now?
Well, this is actually our second annual conference on race, place, and the environment. Our last conference dealt with looking back to look forward, but this time we decided to focus on rebuilding, reclaiming, and revitalizing the city because we wanted it to be a conference with a more positive kind of stroke. At our last conference, it was pretty depressing to find out all the horrible things that had happened to us, but there are a lot of good things going on in the city.
Give me an example, if you can, of one of those good things.
One thing that we tried to focus on was a project in the Holy Cross area, for example, where community residents have organized and they're trying to come back and build sustainably. And the point is that communities are coming back block by block, and they're doing a lot of it on their own. Our interest was in exposing what's considered race-neutral policies that, in fact, are having a racial impact on the city, and it is in fact, supporting communities that are mostly white and affluent and got very little damage at the expense of communities that are mostly minority and less affluent and receive the most damage. And so these supposed race-neutral policies are having an inverse impact on the communities, and we're saying the policies should be race-sensitive, not race-neutral. And that was one of the big findings at the conference.
Now, Dr. Strong, you at Dillard have taken some Herculean efforts to try to rebuild. You got a $400 million program to restore and upgrade the campus. First of all, have there been environmental challenges in doing that? And secondly, how did you find the money?
Well, yes, there have been. And we are rising above the effects of Katrina. It's clear that we suffered more than $400 million in damage. And essentially, our efforts to right that included not only monies that we would secure from insurance, but also additional grantsmanship that we had to undertake. There were several achievements, $160 million in a 1% loan that we were able to engineer through Washington, $40 million in federal grants, another $42 million in private support. That included more than 200 congressional contacts and 125 meetings in Washington, maybe over the score of 10 to 12 agencies during the first year and a half of effort. And we've made some significant progress. And the importance of this, of course, is that we were just devastated. We lost several buildings. The damage to buildings, historic buildings on this campus, resulted in not being able to return to our campus for over a year. We held classes in the Hilton Hotel. We lived in the Hilton Hotel. We had to lay off two-thirds of our faculty and staff. And so we're coming back. We're coming back strong and bigger and better than ever. And our plans are not just to rebuild the campus, which is now 75% rebuilt, but it is also to understand the importance that this university must play in bringing back the Gentile community.
Each of you, and just quickly, Dr. Wright and then Dr. Strong, the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice moved from Xavier University to Dillard, both historically black institutions. What prompted that, and how will it change the situation of the institute?
Well, our move from Xavier was an amicable move. Xavier University was, to some extent, changing its direction, and they were basically interested in doing sponsored programs mostly around the sciences. On the other hand, while Xavier was moving in that direction, and it is a needed direction, Dillard University was beginning to look more at connecting with communities and doing more within the New Orleans community in terms of social justice and educational issues. And so it just was a better fit for us at that particular time. And the college presidents at the time actually met and talked. And so it was an amicable move. It wasn't an adversarial move at all. I want to make that clear.
Absolutely. Dr. Strong, why'd you bring the Institute in?
Because we had the vision to recognize it was important, it's excellent, it is focused on community and public policy. Those are important values that Dillard University holds dear and is at the core of our forward thinking in terms of strategic planning. And it's a priority for this university to be at the cutting edge in public policy. We believe that the Deep South Center is one of those programs that will help symbolize the new Dillard, and that it was important to continue to expand our programs in ways mentioned, and most importantly, it's introducing this community to the whole world of sustainability and environmental justice. It provides a replicable model that can be utilized elsewhere across this country.
Well, Dr. Wright, Dr. Strong, thank you for your time.
Thank
You're
you.
You're so very welcome.
Beverly Wright is director of the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice at Dillard University, and Walter Strong is executive vice president of Dillard University. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. FBI statistics show that every 12 seconds a woman is beaten by her husband or boyfriend. Some perpetrators get jail time, but what other ways are there to prevent violence against women? To answer that question, we're joined by News and Notes contributor Judge Lynn Toler. Judge Toler is a former municipal court judge and now hosts the syndicated television show Divorce Court. It's great to have you on again.
Good to be here.
So for years, police took a somewhat light approach, sometimes just taking an abuser out and taking a walk and saying, don't do this again. But in recent years, they've stepped up their enforcement. So that's good. But what are some of the other ways to treat this issue?
That is good. And it's very important to understand how this has evolved. Yes, it used to be it's his house. It's not that big a deal. It has evolved into an idea where, yes, the criminal justice system has to take it seriously. So they have now preferred arrest policies where the police have to arrest. And if they don't arrest in a domestic violence situation, they have to explain it. And prosecutors then stepped up and said, we're going to have a no drop policy. In other words, we're going to assume, as often is the case, that the woman is going to ask, hey, don't prosecute him. Let him go. And he says, no, the state of Ohio or the state of Arizona or wherever you are says, this is our charge, this is a crime, and we're going to follow through. Then it's up to the judiciary, and everyone used to look to the judiciary. Now you have to be serious and sentence these guys. That in and of itself was not working, because once he was out, you are sending the man and the mindset back to the same home and the same woman with the same mindset. And so the taking it seriously and simply incarcerating was not resolving the problem.
So what other ways are there?
Now we are taking a more holistic approach to the problem. It is an approach that tries to sew up the seams of the system. I had a domestic violence group come to me and say, look, Judge, we aren't getting what we need. We're not getting to the women soon enough. You are not getting the men to domestic violence program well enough or quickly enough. So what they did, asked me to do, was to put together a coordinated community response to domestic violence that put together one whole response, counseling, law enforcement, social service, employment services, housing assistance, all of those things that affect a woman. Because it's kind of like the judicial response to the question, why doesn't she just leave? And the answer to that is because you're asking her to deconstruct her entire life. So when you ask someone to do that, you have to have a way to hold them up while they do that. And now this response is becoming more popular and, in fact, has morphed into the Family Justice Center Initiative in 2006, which federally recognizes the answer to why doesn't she just leave, and in so doing gave it money and, you know, a broad-based idea and funding to put that idea into process.
Do you think something like that initiative is actually working?
I think it does. I think it's a difficult thing to talk about with respect to numbers in the beginning because it is such a, what do you call a victory? if she gets out of the house and doesn't get killed, you don't have that number with you. So it takes a long time to define what a victory is. And a victory to one woman in just feeling better about herself or getting out of the situation or having him change a little bit while he's still in the house, that is still a victory. So what we had been doing isn't working. We know that much. And we know that when you deal with a problem on a multi-tiered level, so you can deal with all of the roadblocks that women enter into as victims in the system, it's bound to help. How soon we know what the numbers are or how important sheer numbers are, I'm not so certain.
Now, how did it make you feel that what you had been doing as a judge alone was not working? Did you begin to question at all, you know, what it means to be a judge and that judges are supposedly going to be able to solve these problems? It sounds like you were very open. How did you feel? And then also, do you think that other judges are receptive to this approach?
I felt impotent and unsuccessful. And I think I felt that way throughout my tenure on the bench because I spent so much time believing that the real value I had was off the bench. When I saw what the problems were and how deep the women were, what I did was go to a school with and had groups of girls that were 14 and 15. And the first question I would ask them is, how many of you plan to be abused when you grow up? And of course, nobody raised their hand. I said, now the statistic tells me that 1/3 of you will. So how do we get from here to there? And we have that. I had that conversation because I believe it is off the bench that I could do my best work. Judges, as people, as institutions, are very opposed to change. I mean, that's just the way we are in human nature. But I think that there are a lot of judges out there who are very open to the idea, and you just have to give it time as the older generation goes away. I remember when I first became a judge, one of the judges said to me, it was 1994, yeah, I put him on probation and I make them go out, take their wives out to dinner as a response to domestic violence, which to me demonstrated complete misunderstanding as to the nature of the problem. Now that's no longer the case. And as these initiatives broaden and you understand their impact, I think judges are going to be more open to the prospect of change.
You know, something you said made me think about your role now as the presiding judge on Divorce Court, which, of course, is a television show.
Right.
Do you ever face talking about these issues on the show?
I try to steer away from domestic violence on the show because it is a TV show and I cannot take it seriously. And it is such a serious and important issue. I did talk about it on one show where I had two episodes that was dedicated to the issue of domestic violence. But it's not something that can be treated lightly.
But you did speak with the Reverend Juanita Bynum about the
issue. I did do that. And I thought it was a unique opportunity. Normally, I wouldn't allow it on domestic violence. They gave me opportunity. They said, we have a woman here who is very well known and who wants to speak about it happened to me, because there's a lot of shame and there's a lot of closet and darkness that allows this stuff to grow. And I saw it as a unique opportunity to take a very current issue, a very current situation with Dr. Bynum, and shine light on something we usually don't talk about.
And just for those who don't know the history, Reverend Bynum was married to, or I guess still is at this point, married to another prominent figure who had a very spectacular domestic violence incident in a public space. Just quickly before we let you go, what do you think that she has had to offer or say about this issue?
Number one, she had light to offer. I remember reading in Essence an article she wrote, I didn't want to talk about what was going on in the house because I felt stupid. And I think a lot of women feel that sense of shame associated with that, especially women who are in more elevated circumstances, who feel that it's not a problem, that it's in the upper classes. So I think it shone light on it. And I think with the light comes the ability to see, and with that ability to see comes the ability to change, because it has to be way before it gets to the judiciary. It has to be in the minds and hearts of people and how we respond to each other in a social setting.
Well, Judge Toler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was News and Notes contributor Judge Lynn Toler. Judge Toler is a former municipal court judge and now hosts the syndicated television show Divorce Court. She joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we take a look at the primary results from Oregon and Kentucky with our political experts, Donna Brazile and Robert Trainum. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
Support for NPR comes from the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art. Now showing Take Your Time, Olafur Eliasson. Details at moma.org. From Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world. On the web at kauffman.org. And from AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Site, you know, a lot of them been deported. They should have been deported, different things like that. So it gives the police the right to just go after them directly. You know, you don't have to wait until they kill somebody or until they commit a crime. You can do it like preventive maintenance. You go in there and you get them before they kill someone. The way it is now, the LAPD can't ask someone solely upon that. But if you get pulled over for expired registration, they can ask everybody, no matter what color you are. You know, are you illegally in the United States? Are you a U.S. citizen? You don't have to profile just with Latinos or Asians. You just ask every person that you pull over for any reason. You can ask them driver's license, registration, proof of insurance, and are you a citizen of the United States?
Now, Sergeant Shaw, some people say that there will be racial profiling. And in addition to that, that your crusade, although your son was brutally murdered, could really increase the tensions between blacks and Latinos. How do you feel about that?
I don't think that's true. I don't think it could get any worse than where it is at right now. Because, like Jamel said, we target everyone. If the police target everyone, then how would it be racial profiling?
Plus, on top of that, we're only after illegal alien gangbangers. We're not targeting Latinos in general. We're not targeting illegal immigrants that are trying to make it better for themselves. I mean, that's not what we're doing. We're targeting illegal alien gangbangers. You know, because this guy was a legal alien. He was in the country illegally. He had a long rap sheet. He had just got out of jail for assault with a deadly weapon, resisting arrest. 28 hours, he got back on the streets and assembled a whole crew, you know. So we know this came from the shot callers in prison. There's no way this guy, being 19, was able to get out in 24 hours and get guns, cars, drivers, a crew of people, all in 24 hours. So we know there's a big problem, you know, and this guy saw my son because he was black. He saw this black kid walking on a quiet street, and he was out there looking for blacks to kill anyway. So he just stumbled up on my son, but at the same time, he stumbled up on public outcry. This has been going on before my son was murdered. This isn't the first time. It's just been disguised, you know, and people are waking up and realizing that there are people out there today that are killing people because of their skin color.
And now, Sergeant Shaw, I want to ask you a sensitive question. There is a blog called Street Gangs Journal that says your son might have been what's called a claimer for the Roland 20s NHB gang, part of the Bloods. And a claimer is someone who's not active in a gang but who identifies with it. And there are also, according to some anti-gang activists, gang-related comments on your son's MySpace page and a photo of him allegedly throwing up a gang sign. So do you think your son was part of a gang and that this killing was a gang issue, not an immigration issue?
No, I don't. I don't think in no way, no how that my son was in a gang.
What do you think about the issue? In addition, there's now a coalition of groups, including Project Islamic Hope and the Latino and African American Leadership Alliance. They held an event to pressure MySpace to take down all sites that have gang images or texts. And they're doing it, saying that, linking it to your son's death, saying that this should be a general preventative measure. What do you think about that being one way of reacting to your son's death?
I think that's a good thing, because no one can prove to me, I don't know how they prove it to anyone else, that he actually wrote, that was actually his MySpace page.
Mr. Shaw, I'm going to ask you the same thing. I mean, do you believe that your son's killing was gang-related in the sense that he was a claimer or a member of a gang?
No, that's ludicrous. You know, from the very beginning, there have been people that have been trying to label this as a gang crime because they don't want to accept the fact that he was killed because he was black. You know, now, you know, MySpace page that, you know, no one has proven that he even did it. The pictures go with the words. He wrote the words. It's just people's opinion, and they don't understand this is about facts, that my son was killed by a legal alien gangbanger that was identified and documented in the database, had a long jail sentence, been in the juvenile authorities. You know, he's just been a problem from the very beginning. And then my son was an athlete, documented athlete, that's been cleared by the police chief, the sheriff department. They've been to jail, never been in a gang profile, never been suspended from school. He was doing the right thing. He was coming home. He wasn't out there running the streets. Espinoza, on the other hand, was in that database. Why aren't all these guys going after Espinoza and trying to show people what's going on with illegal alien gangbangers? But they need a motive, and so they're going to just fabricate anything. They're just grabbing at straws just to bring my son down so they can stop the Special Order 40, Jamil's Law, and anything that represents good over evil.
Sergeant, last week the prosecutor in charge of your son's case was removed, and some people say it's because that prosecutor wouldn't charge Espinoza with a hate crime. Mr. Shaw, you're quoted as saying the prosecutor was pro-gang. Now, I'm going to ask you both that question. Sergeant Shaw first. Do you think that it's key that Espinoza be charged with a hate crime?
I think it's key that he be charged with a hate crime and also with the the other charges that they have against him, too.
Mr. Shaw?
Yeah, that's right, because see, Pedro Espinoza was identified, documented, tattoos all over his body that's, you know, that's stating that he's in 18th Street. He's been in jail before for being in 18th Street problems. You know, he's been carrying around firearms pretty much his whole life. You know, by him being in the all these different penal institutions, you know, they keep him segregated, and all they do is have hate. You know, they just hate each other. So being that he just got the county jail, all he was talking about was hate. So, you know, they got him set up with a crew. He got out, and he was able to show how much he hates black people, you know. And plus, we already know he's in the game. We don't want to either or. We want him to have hate crime added, because when he saw my son, all he saw was this black guy walking down the street.
Mr. Shaw, let me put the focus back on Jamil's Law. There is a proposal by an L.A. City Councilman, Dennis Zine, who wants to change some aspects of Special Order 40, but you specifically are starting a signature drive to get a public vote on Jamil's Law. What's the difference between Dennis Zine's proposal and yours?
Well, Dennis Zine's proposal wants you to wait until they commit a crime before you can ask them about their immigration status. You know, that's crazy, because Pedro Espinoza has been in jail since he was 12 years old, in and out, just violent act after violent act, and he never really got in trouble. No one never checked him to see was he in the country illegally. ICE never checked it out, Sheriff's Department. So we know that didn't work. The day he got out, he had just went in for assault with a deadly weapon, which was a gun, resisting arrest, and they still never checked. So they waited until now that he's murdered somebody, which was my son. Now all of a sudden they want to check him to make sure if he's here or not. If they would have did their job March the 1st, he would have been deported. He would have never murdered my son or anybody else's son. It's apparent that this guy has done that before. There's no way you can walk up on somebody clearly because they're black and just kill them just because they're there. You know, that's crazy. And we're not going to take it. This is a U.S. citizen he killed. He didn't just kill anybody. He's not from here. He's illegal. He's a legal alien. My son was a U.S. citizen, deserves every right to be where he was at, to chase the American dream. They're trying to get the American dream, but we're entitled to it. We're Americans. Only thing my son did was come home. He was three houses from his front door.
El Salvador originally.
Yes. I came here in fifth grade.
And were you legal status at that time?
No.
How did you manage to get legal status to, you know, be able to go to college and all that?
So, you know, throughout high school, I did everything I had to do, everything teachers told me, everything counselors told me, community leaders, but I was undocumented. So when I got to college, I couldn't apply for financial aid, and it was very difficult for me to pursue a higher education and pursue my dreams just because I didn't have a 9-digit Social Security number.
Let's turn to the case of Jamil Shaw. There are plenty of immigrants who are legal immigrants from Mexico, Latin America, other places in the world, as well as people like yourself who are able to get legal status and become permanent residents here. Do you think that this is going to cause tensions that are really going to divide blacks and Latinos in Los Angeles?
I think we cannot. There's already division within our community. And so, but I think the bigger issue with Jamil's Law is that, you know, this law can eliminate other issues that I think are critical to our community. And that is really that we're talking here about when we use the word illegal immigrants and illegal aliens, you know, images arise in people's minds. And so, you know, Espinoza's story becomes my story. And I think that's the danger, that I may be judged because of what he did. And so that's why I'm against it, because there's a very thin line, and this is a very sensitive issue. I agree that, you know, if Espinoza shot Jamil and he's found guilty, then he should be punished, right? But I think what's at stake here is that, you know, we need to talk about the broader issues that are at stake here. And that really is that a lot of undocumented students and workers can be targeted by that police, because we cannot deny that racial profiling is going to exist if this law is passed.
So what do you hope can come out of this situation? It's obviously a tragedy. there's the potential for this to be divisive no matter what happens with this specific law or with the other proposal by the city council. So your student group is dedicated to building bridges. How are you going to go about trying to do that?
You know, I think this is a great opportunity for brown and black to come together to solve some of the common problems that we face. For example, the lack of opportunities, you know, lack of resources in our school system, how we're not, a lot of students are not going to college. And so we face all these common problems on healthcare and education. And so I think this is a great opportunity to come together and solve some of the common problems that we have. And the way we approach it in search is that we say, you know, let's get to know each other. Let's get to know our stories and see that we are all connected here. And that if we are all connected, then we can move forward pushing an agenda that is not divisive, but rather, you know, just working together to fix things.
Some people are saying that Jameel Shaw Jr. might have been affiliated with a rival gang. Does that affect how you feel about his death or about the actions that are being taken?
You know, there's no, like, sufficient proof to prove that he was or that he wasn't. So my thing is that I'm not going to judge him. I know it's a tragedy, but I want to take this opportunity. And so instead of fighting against each other and being, you know, instead of creating more divisions, we can come together around a common purpose.
Now, some activists are also calling for a ban on all gang-related activity on MySpace. So do you think that that's something that would be good for younger people in Los Angeles as well as across the country?
I think it's a start. You know, I think it's good that those gang signs or gang activity on MySpace be taken out. But I think that the broader problem is that how are we going to solve this issue of gang violence in our communities? And that's what I want to talk about. But the root of the problem, because, you know, if we deport every gang member, right, what happened was that, you know, back in the 90s, a lot of gang members were deported to El Salvador and Central America, but that did not solve the problem. The problem was just transformed to another place. And what happened was that the gang grew more and more. And so I think the problem is really how we come together and solve it. And we can begin to solve it by sharing our stories and beginning to know that we need to work together, but also, you know, creating gang prevention programs that a lot of young people do not have to go through, you know, the harassment that exists in our communities by gang members.
You know, here's something that comes to mind for me. You're someone who is living the American dream and who's had to fight pretty hard to get to that point. But how much can someone like you really do to work on people who have a very different life, people who are gang members, regardless of color? Do you think that people in your generation who are students, who are workers, who are trying to play by the rules, can really have a dialogue with people who have given up on leading a law-abiding life?
I certainly think we can. I think it's all a matter of first, listening to people. You know, we live in a country that we don't listen to each other and that we don't really take into account other people's opinion. And that's where we began. You know, we need to listen to the Shaw family and we need to listen to different opinions and then make up our mind about how is it that we're going to solve some of the problems that we face. And that, again, you know, we're all united in this. And I think that we can take this opportunity to really solve some of the underlying root causes of the problems that exist in our communities.
Furman, thank you.
Thank you.
Furman Vasquez is a student at Cal State University in Los Angeles and the president of Students United to Reach Goals in Education. He joined me in the studios of NPR West right here in Cal. Begins for an African Einstein in South Africa this week. At least 24 people have been killed in a wave of attacks on foreigners. And we look at Rwanda's new economic force, women. For more, we've got Roxanne Lawson. She's director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum. Hey, Roxanne.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. So let's talk about some disturbing news from South Africa. It's the biggest economic power on the continent, and plenty of immigrants from other African nations are flooding into the country, legally or not. South Africans are accusing these immigrants of taking away jobs and causing crime. In some ways, it's similar to a lot of the debates right here in the U.S. Now, some South Africans are getting into brutal attacks on foreigners. At least 24 people have been killed in unrest that broke out a week ago. So what's the latest on the violence?
You're directly right that it actually is very much like what we see here in the United States with our migration issues. As of this morning, official reports that 217 people have been arrested, over 3,000 have been displaced, and 22 people are dead.
Now, reports say a majority of the victims are Zimbabwean. I actually was in South Africa about 15 months ago, and I saw what some people call Little Zimbabwe, an area where many of the people who are leaving for economic and political reasons have settled. So how were they being targeted, and what do you think the South Africans who are engaging in this want? Do they want to drive people out? What do they want?
Well, there's been a history in independent South Africa of immigration problems and tension. Right now in South Africa, there's a 40% unemployment rate, a huge shortage of housing, both public and private housing, as well as a global food crisis that's impacting poor South Africans disproportionately. And so I think for all of those reasons, we see, as all over the globe, a rise in xenophobia. For people who are, you know, migrants in Southern Africa from Zimbabwe, I think that people in South Africa are very concerned that the unresolved electoral issues in Zimbabwe, frankly, that Zimbabwe doesn't have an elected government in power right now, will create an even greater rise in Zimbabweans flooding across the border. Right now, it's estimated that about 3 million Zimbabweans live both documented and undocumented in South Africa, and that number will rise.
Well, what are South Africa's policies on both immigration and people who are of refugee status?
South Africa has some very liberal policies, as it has a very liberal constitution on migration and immigration. I think with that, though, is a history since 1994 of xenophobia and of a backlash against that very liberal migration policy. We saw in 1994 the Inkatha Freedom Party actually really try to take physical action or threaten to take physical action if the government failed to crack down on undocumented workers in South Africa. We saw similarly later on in that decade a study that was done by the Human Sciences Research Council and the Institute for Security Studies in South Africa that reported that 65% of South Africans were in support of forced repatriation of undocumented migrants in their country. And so I think that history of violence against not just Zimbabweans, but Somalis, Mozambicans, and Angolans has just played itself out in larger and larger ways here in the last couple of weeks. And that Zimbabwe has been, I mean, that Zimbabwe and South Africa, both governments have been trying to respond to this recent wave of migration, but their responses have not been enough.
All right. I want to move on to an interesting initiative. Physicist Stephen Hawking is looking for Africa's Einstein. What he wants to do with a bunch of entrepreneurs and scientists is to create Africa's postgraduate centers for advanced math and physics, places that don't exist yet. And it's planned to cost 75 million British pounds or over 150 million U.S. dollars. Hawking said, quote, "The world of science needs Africa's brilliant talents." So what exactly is this plan going to do?
This plan is actually quite interesting. It is not just the brainchild of Mr. Hawking, but also of a South African, Neil Torek. And it is set up to actually try to create institutions of higher learning focusing on math and sciences on the African continent, which will hope to draw Africans from all over the continent to study on the continent and to further advance the great history that Africa has had actually in influencing and changing Western science and math.
Now, when you think about Africa, there's been a huge brain drain, as there's been for many other nations around the world. India is one of them, where you create people who go out and get degrees in math and science, computers, medicine, etc., and then they go other places. Do you think that even if this plan works, that people won't stay in African countries?
I think that if this plan works, people may, professionals may stay in African nations. I mean, there's so much that's involved in why highly trained professionals migrate out of the African continent. And part of that is the way in which international aid and development are both enacted on the continent and the demand that we create for those highly trained individuals from Africa and the U.S. But I think that more importantly than that, I think it will help, I hope, for the United States, for Africans, for the entire world to actually really understand the great contributions in history that Africa has made to math and sciences over the last 4,000 years. I think that's really not understood in a real way. And so,
well, give me an example.
Oh, I can give you several. I mean,
just start with one.
We know that the first medical texts in the world actually originated from parts of the continent. There also, in 1978, two U.S. American scientists, Smith and Avery, discovered, quote-unquote, that the first smelting of steel in the world was done in Tanzania about 15 to 2,000 years ago, and that the machine used a semiconductive technology, one that actually, for the rest of the Western world, wasn't invented, quote-unquote, until the 1970s. And so we see that For example, we also have an example. I'm sorry you only asked for one, but I can't help myself. From the Dogon, people who live in West Africa, their ability to both their contributions and ability to astronomy worldwide have been highly documented, but that we in the West know very little about those contributions.
All right. Well, let's finally move on to Rwanda. Last month was the 14th anniversary of the genocide where 800,000 Rwandans were killed. We've seen depictions of that genocide in movies like Hotel Rwanda. But in the past 14 years, the country has rebuilt economically and in terms of relations between people of different ethnic groups. Women have helped push that change. So, Roxanne, what kind of roles are Rwandan women playing?
Rwandan women are really a force to be reckoned with. We saw that in 2003, 48.8% of the seats in Rwanda's lower house of parliament were taken over by women. That's the highest rate in the world. And that's really literally 40 years after Rwandan women were given the right to vote and independence. We've also seen that there's been a rise in women entrepreneurship for a couple of different reasons. First, that fertile lands that were left barren because of the slaughter of husbands, fathers, and brothers were taken up by women, wives, and daughters, and we were able to make those lands viable. We've also seen by international financial institutions and investors a real desire and need to invest in women as entrepreneurs in Rwanda. And so we've seen a 50% increase in women who can read and write in Rwanda since the genocide, as well as 71% of them have bettered their economic situation, both through their own personal entrepreneurship because they're market women or farmers and in diverse things as in coffee and bean exports. And so that's actually really been quite wonderful and one of the unknown or unwritten aspects of the outcome of genocide has been that there's been a place that's opened up for women in Rwanda to really take the lead in that country.
And just quickly, are these women doing, you know, independent projects or working together to form larger businesses or both?
They're doing both. I mean, there are a couple of really well-known co-ops in Rwanda of women who've come together to do both large and small-scale farming. There are also individual women entrepreneurs who are changing the face of media, of technology in Rwanda, as well as lots of women who've become PMs and are on all levels of government taking leadership. And they've been able to, through all of these things, really change both national GDP investment and also personal investment into families, into home renovation, improvement in nutrition, etc.
Well, Roxanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure as always.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum, and she was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Next on News and Notes, how safe is New Orleans for its residents almost 3 years after Hurricane Katrina? We talked to some folks at the historically black Dillard University. Plus, Judge Lynn Toler tells us about a different approach to dealing with domestic violence.